Broadcasting from the Investor Hour studios and all around the world, you're listening to the Stansberry Investor Hour. Tune in each Thursday on iTunes, Google Play, and everywhere you find podcasts for the latest episodes of the Stansberry Investor Hour. Sign up for the free show archive at investorhour.com. Here's your host, Dan Ferris.
Hello and welcome to the Stansberry Investor Hour. I'm your host, Dan Ferris. I'm also the editor of Extreme Value, published by Stansberry Research. Today we'll talk with value investor and author Aaron Edelheit. Aaron will tell us one of his favorite stocks right now. It's a familiar name, but I bet you've never heard anyone talk about it like this. This week in the mailbag, more questions about crypto. And once again, I'll reach out to the boss of my crypto posse, Eric Wade, for some answers. What he said will not disappoint. Also, questions about trailing stops, and physician and listener Lincoln B says he cringes when I talk about COVID-19. In my opening rant this week, I'll talk about good guys and bad guys versus good thinking and bad thinking. Heavy stuff, but very useful for investors. That and more right now on the Stansberry Investor Hour. Okay, let's talk about good guys and bad guys versus good thinking and bad thinking. Now, first thing I want to tell you is I recognize there is such a thing in this world as bad guys and good guys. My point today is going to be that these labels apply far, far, far less often than I believe most people apply them today. And I'll give a real good example of that to show you what I mean. Then we're going to get away from that. We're going to talk about the difference between good thinking and bad thinking. And I didn't have to look any farther than our own mailbag for two excellent examples. Okay, let's not get into good guys, all right? Because that's for another day. But there is such a thing as bad guys. I was reading a book called The Road. It's a novel. I read it on Sunday. It's by Cormac McCarthy. It's really good. It won a Pulitzer Prize. It's a post-apocalyptic vision of the world. I won't get into it. I won't spoil it for you. But one thing is, like, the bad guys in that are really bad. They'll kill you and eat you, okay? That's the bad guys. And to me, that's a bad guy, a truly bad guy. I'm sure there are bad guys who are a little less bad than that, but I just want to make the point in a very extreme way. And short of cannibalism, you know, you should be careful, I think. You know, cannibalism and other horrible, horrible crimes against human beings, right? You should be careful about labeling people good and bad. And I think the very obvious example in our culture, in our society today, is politics. I live on the left coast of the United States. You can't show up at a cocktail party and push anything but hard lefty liberal ideas without kind of being people, they'll sort of look at you funny, and the worst conversation, they'll shout you down and treat you like your ideas are not allowed to be heard. And you've seen this. We see this on social media. You see it on all the big news networks. You know, you look at like CNN versus Fox. One's right, one's left, whatever. It's a little silly because the world isn't really that way, is it? Everyone is not morally evil on the left. That's what the right will tell you. And then the left will tell you everyone on the right is morally evil. That's a bad, bad way of looking at things. And I'm going to give you an example of that kind of thinking in a minute here. The problem there is if you're really thinking about things, if you're a mature adult human being who's really thinking, you know that life is filled with trade-offs. Everything isn't all black and white and good and bad. Everything is trade-offs, okay? And that is, I think that's the proper way to look at life rather than to look at everything as an exercise in moral superiority and black and white thinking. So I believe we're infected to a great degree in our time, and maybe in other times, but definitely in our own time, we're infected to a great degree. And I think this affects investors too. People got this way about tobacco stocks and tobacco companies. And some people are this way about like Facebook or even like Google or something. I don't think they're evil companies. And you say, well, tobacco, you know, they lied about how bad cigarette smoking was and all this stuff. Look, you got nothing to tell me about that. My mother smoked for, it was like 50 years. She started when she was 14, and I don't think she stopped until she was in her early 60s. She has she's 93 now. She has COPD. You know, without oxygen tanks, she would have been gone some time ago. You know, she needs that oxygen to live. So I get it. I get it. It has bad effects. But you know what? For a couple of decades before she actually quit, she had 7 children and a husband saying, you really shouldn't do that. You really shouldn't do that. And she chose to do it anyway. She made the trade-off. And you know what? When we said you shouldn't do that, she said, I know. Okay? So she made the trade-off. And I'm not saying it's easy to quit either, okay? Don't write in and say, you don't get it, man. They're addicted. It's hard to quit. No, she quit. So you should think in terms of making trade-offs, not moral superiority. And this, like I said, it gets into things like tobacco companies, which in the end were selling a product that people wanted to consume. And even after their big master settlement agreement in 1998, I think in the first 25 years of that agreement, they paid, you know, they're scheduled to pay something like a total of $200 billion out. Insane. And if you really want to get moralistic, you should look at the municipalities that they're paying it out to, who are like securitizing the debt and loading your town up with debt. Another topic. Anyway, I think it's a mistake to say, well, tobacco companies are evil. Look, some people want to smoke. Other people want to buy the stock. It's none of your damn business if you don't want to do it, right? Same with like Facebook. You say, Facebook is bad for my kids. I took it off all the computers. It shouldn't be allowed to exist, blah, blah, blah. Well, people want to use it. Facebook wants to provide it. Some people want to own the stock. None of your business. It's between them, not you. You see what I'm getting at? If you have a moralistic vision of the world where you're always trying to foist your view, that's the problem. We politically try to foist our view on people and it doesn't work. Here's an example of this thinking in the mailbag. Deb H. writes in and says, I have enjoyed reading some of your articles. However, I will not be reading any more. If you promote a person who supposedly gave George Soros investment advice, she's referring to our interview with Rupal Bhansali, who was brilliant. It was a wonderful interview last week. You should listen to it if you haven't already. And then she continues, I know he is a billionaire. He uses his money to promote racist, socialist agendas. He is funding the violence disguised as Black Lives Matter protests by paying agitators to ignite violence in what may have been a reasonable, peaceful protest. And then she says, do you also support this effort/agenda? Are you trying to tear America apart? I wouldn't trust a thing you say now. That is bad thinking. So she deems Soros morally evil. I don't know if he is or not, and frankly, I don't care. So Rupal Bhansali, therefore, is morally evil. Why? Because she worked for him for a few years. Guess what? Austin Root of Stansberry worked for him for a few years, too. And he worked for Steve Cohen, too. Austin is a wonderful guy. He's a fine human being. Deb H., this is bad thinking. You can't go through life this way. I guess you can go through life this way, but you're just truncating your enjoyment of life. You're truncating your ability to think. Every time you think this way, you're reducing yourself by 5 or 10 IQ points. You know, it's stupid and wrong. And an investor sure as hell cannot afford to think this way. You can't afford to say, well, these are wonderful cash-gushing companies that are probably going to be wonderful cash-gushing businesses for a long time, but I'm not going to own them because they're evil. You should get the hell out of the stock market, okay? You should get out of the stock market if that's the way you want to think. I promise you, you will find something to cop a moral superiority attitude about almost every company. It's ridiculous, okay? That's an example of what I think is really bad thinking. An example of good thinking is from a listener who was also one of our previous guests, Kevin Duffy. And Kevin Duffy says, hi, Dan, another great interview with Rupal Bhansali. Loved her comments on Apple and risk management. You talked about sentiment indicators, particularly AAII and COT, on stock index futures. This is a long conversation, but the Cliff Notes version is that numbers impress, statistics lie, and all sentiment indicators should be taken with a grain of salt. With so many floating around, it's easy to succumb to confirmation bias. It just so happens that the two you cited are notoriously poor indicators. Whenever I hear them trotted out, I'm immediately suspicious. Meanwhile, more reliable indicators, investors intelligence, NAAIM, equity fund cash levels, margin debt are all flashing red. And then he continued some more in this vein. And I'm okay with him criticizing me. Kevin's been a good critic. He's a very thoughtful guy, and I think he's generally been right. I think the real point here about the sentiment indicators is that if you use two of them, you should cite like five or six of them, because he's right. He says in this email, the sentiment indicator landscape is rarely black and white, right? So, which, you know, that's the theme of this rant here today, right? So if I made a mistake, that really is the mistake that I made. I only gave you two sentiment indicators when really it's a whole landscape of them, and they're rarely all line up in the same direction. And, I don't know that those others are any necessarily better. But that's good thinking. It's analytical thinking. It's not moralistic. It's just, this works, this doesn't, maybe this is a good idea. And the overall idea that sentiment indicators are flaky, so you really should look at all of them at once because they're rarely all black and white. That is an excellent point. All investors need to understand that if they're going to look at sentiment. You see the difference? Deb H. moralized and said, nothing I ever say. She won't trust a thing I say now, right? It's like saying, I'll never trust a thing Mark Zuckerberg says. Well, he's the guy who created Facebook, and that's one of the greatest businesses of all time. It gushes free cash flow. And I think the free cash flow margin last year is like 30%. If you screen for that, you'll find about 5 or 10 companies, okay? It's incredible. And the people who use it, they use it. They know what they're doing. You shouldn't moralize about them and try to, well, you know, this thing shouldn't exist. When you say the thing shouldn't exist, you're saying that people don't know what they're doing. You know, you're better than they are, and you know how society ought to be rearranged. And you're okay with the investment implications of that. You're okay with wiping out billions of dollars of investment. I think that's all I have to say about that. Okay? Let's move on, and let's talk with Aaron Edelheit, who's one of the smartest investors I've ever met in my life. I can't wait to talk to him. Have you ever wanted to invest in real estate but aren't sure what to invest in or how to find the right deals? On Wednesday, my good friend Steve Sugarrood hosted a webinar explaining his 20-year track record in real estate and how to buy in this market. Steve also uncovered an exciting new opportunity to recommend private real estate deals. Deals that until recently were only available to the richest Americans. But starting right now, you can invest in them nearly just as easy as if you were buying a stock through your brokerage account. You won't want to miss this opportunity. Go to stevenewproject.com. Again, that's stevenewproject.com. We have a new show here at Stansberry Research. It's a weekly recap inside Stansberry Research and the world. Our financial correspondent, Jessica Stone, hosts it each Friday at 5 p.m., and we hope you'll give it a listen. Find it everywhere you listen to podcasts, including StansberryInsiderWeekly.com. Today's guest is Aaron Edelheit. Aaron Edelheit is the CEO and founder of Mindset Capital, a private investment firm. After being one of their first investors, Aaron was also the chief strategy officer of Flow Technologies and helped the company grow from a pre-revenue startup to raising $28 million and launching in over 500 Home Depot stores. In his previous role as CEO of The American Home, Aaron founded and grew a company from 16 rental homes to one that owned 2,500 single-family rental homes and was sold in April 2015 to a publicly traded real estate investment trust. He's also the founder and ran a successful money management firm called Sabre Value Management from 1998 to 2011. In 2018, Idea Press published Aaron's first book, The Hard Break, The Case for a 24/6 Lifestyle. The book makes the case for taking one day a week off from work, email, and smartphones for a more productive, healthier, and more creative life. Aaron has also been featured and quoted in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Bloomberg, CNBC, among others, and has given lectures on business and entrepreneurship in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. Aaron, welcome back to the program, sir.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
So last time we talked about your book, which is a really cool book. It's kind of the resource on taking a day off each week. And, you know, we talked about your start as an investor, but this time around, you're back into equity analysis and investing in equities again. Like, I saw you talking about this on Twitter and I was like, wow, I didn't expect that. What is it specifically that has you so excited? Let's get into that today.
So, sure. So, one thing I will say is, like, this week is a wonderful example. I'm so excited for my Sabbath and my day off. Tomorrow, I cannot tell you, but that's a little side note. With all the nuttiness of the world, I still will make my plug for everyone trying to unplug. So what I would say first off is that I've always been an investor. I don't know why. I've been reading the Wall Street Journal from a very young age, fascinated by research, researching investments, the business world. And I realized earlier this year that I really missed spending most, if not all, of my time researching companies and finding investments that were publicly traded, and decided to refocus. And I have a small friends and family money management partnership that I launched. And I'm frankly just having a blast. I realized that it's one of the great loves of my life. If that might sound pretty weird, is I just love researching companies and diving in and finding either companies that are misunderstood, companies people have never heard of, or companies in the midst of a turnaround, or all three. And so, you know, I took about a 9-year break from 2012, while I decided to focus on the American home and grew that, you know, as you mentioned, from 16 rental homes to 2,500. Then joined a friend's startup. And I really am, the way I view it is I'm getting back to kind of one of my first loves, and really is research and investing. And this is just such an incredible time to do it, even though it's such fraught with risk and there's so much uncertainty, mainly because there's such a dispersion of values. And everyone looks at the indices and says, oh my gosh, the market's so expensive, the market's so high. And not really realizing that there, if you strip away the you know, the top five companies, I think now represent about a quarter of the S&P 500. And I bet if you were to take the top 50, they would represent most of it. But it's even more dramatic kind of when you go down into small cap and micro cap. And now that I'm back kind of spending a lot of time, I just see tremendous opportunity within small and medium, and even some large caps that are misunderstood, that I think are misunderstood. But I think this is just, this is this kind of moment when everyone's so focused on the virus and politics and emotions are inflamed and the Federal Reserve is pumping lots of money in. There's just, this is the opportunity for, in my view, for a fundamental analyst to come in, put your head down and really invest in companies that frankly have really bright outlooks, or no one's ever heard of, or have been unfairly beaten down.
So there aren't a lot of people talking about companies being beaten down right now. I hear more people talking about whether or not they want to speculate on the market going higher or not, and talking about the general overvaluation of like the S&P 500. But there aren't a lot of people like you talking about this. And for a little context, you tweeted that you think this period is like around, you know, maybe August 1998, the long-term capital crisis. How is today like then?
Yeah, it just struck me that, you know, people have been trying to look for analogs, how to view this market and how to view what was going on. And I actually got my start. I'll never forget. I literally started above my parents' garage, managing one person's money. I had no money. A friend from college sold his business and knew that I loved this and trusted me when I don't know if anyone should have trusted me. I'm so young and in hindsight naive, but he invested, he gave me the money and I decided to try to make a go of it. And I started in June of 98, and it was actually a horrible time, horrible but slash great time to start. And in the first 3 months, I was down 20-25%. And what happened is long-term capital management levered itself to its eyeballs and was doing a lot of crazy things and blew up. The Federal Reserve had to step in, basically get all the banks and everybody together at the table and bailed the market out. But liquidity seized up. And what happened is they then pumped in enormous amounts of liquidity into the market. And what you then had was the 99-2000 bubble. And I'll never forget that because I'm a contrarian at heart. I'm really looking for orphan or misunderstood companies or stuff that no one's ever heard of. And while I had a good year, and even though I was down 25% in the first 3 months, I rebounded to being positive for the year. But then in 99, I had a really good year, like nothing like the NASDAQ. But then when the NASDAQ broke, all of the high valuation and speculation was really happening in the technology sector. And there was a great dispersion of value. And I remember finding a spinoff that was trading for its cash value, where the parent company had a clause in the SEC filing that if anyone tried to buy it out, they would have to pay them three times the market cap at that point. And finding an oil tubular company that was trading, you know, like for some half of book value. And remember, oil is never going to come back. There's a lot of parallels. And what happened is when the NASDAQ broke, the rest of the market actually was perfectly fine. And the valuations were so low that I then went on to compound at 25% a year for like 4 years. And honestly felt like I was a golden god, only to be humbled by the market in 2030. But that's another story. And so when I'm looking at the analog for this market, is I see we have kind of this crisis, the Federal Reserve and government pumping lots of money in the market, and you have a certain sector of the economy and a certain part of the economy, again, technology, SaaS companies that are trading at very, very high valuations, and some of them probably justified. And small cap value and value kind of companies are literally being called like a dead asset, and they're being called that this time is different. And frankly, I'm finding, and again, they may be right with some industries and some sectors, but I'm finding what I believe is just like world-class values and fantastic values for companies that are down, frankly, 70% from their highs. And it's just really fascinating to me, the analog of that to me, valuation is risk, not volatility. So I don't think I may be taking short-term volatility risk, but in the long run, in terms of impairment of capital, I don't believe I'm taking much in the way of risk right now in the market. And I have optionality on the upside. And this is really kind of my founding kind of philosophy of my new kind of manager firm, which is that I really want to take the risk on the upside. I don't want to take much downside risk. I'm happy to go into situations where the upside is uncertain, but the downside as well. Worst case, I just break even, or I don't make much money, and it's just disappointing. I'm happy with disappointing.
You're happy with disappointing, meaning the upside disappoints, but you didn't lose anything, so who cares? Move on.
That's exactly right. And my bet is if I build a portfolio of these together, some of them are going to hit. And the upside is so uncertain. The upside on some of them could be multiples of my investment. And that overall, the portfolio will do quite well. And some of them may disappoint or just be flat. And so I'm building together this kind of low downside, uncertain upside portfolio. And I'm just really I'm just frankly, it's weird to say this in such a tumultuous time when so many people are having problems and there's so many like real issues, economy and politics, et cetera. But I'm frankly having a blast researching companies that I think actually could have quite a bright future. I'm not paying very much for that potential.
That's really cool. And it's so different from the sort of mainstream stuff. You know, we see all these articles and news stories about Robinhood traders speculating in crazy bankrupt companies and, you know, experimenting with options and futures. And your message is like the opposite.
Yeah, the other thing that I see is just these money managers. I just got a letter the other day. It's like very smart and some of them doing very well. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a politician. I'm not an economist. Like, my goal is not to try. I can try, and I have read a tremendous amount about COVID. And I can tell you the goal as an investor is to, in my view, is to invest an evaluation that if the worst case happens, it really won't be that bad for you. And unfortunately, you can't really find that in a lot of the high-flying companies and a lot of the company. And that's why I think a lot of money managers are, or they're taking on a lot of risk. They see a lot of upside, but they're taking on a lot of risk. And so they feel compelled to make the case that either the virus isn't that bad, it's not going to have much of an impact, or they have to focus on the Fed. To me, I want my head down, and I really want to try to find these. But again, this fits with my own personality of just trying to find companies where, look, if they go down, I'm going to sleep at night. They're not going away. And in some cases, some of them are doing quite well.
That is really cool. And, you know, you're not the only person we've interviewed recently who said this, but overall, it's not a popular message. And I wonder how money managers like yourself, I assume you're managing other people's money at Mindset, and how do you find people who want to hear a message like this at a time like this? It must be very hard.
Well, it's just, frankly, it's just friends and family. I'm not marketing this at all. I'm managing my own money and some friends and family, and I'm doing what I love.
Right, but Aaron, the friends and family are the ones who call you up.
No, that's true. Well, I didn't say all my family or all my friends.
Right.
this is one of the lessons that I learned from 2008 is I'll never forget two close friends who came into my office in March of 2009. And begged for their money out when I was 100% long and I had no choice. And I told them, please, this is not a good time. Please don't do this. But they asked for it. And because they were friends, I wasn't required to give it, but I gave them their money and it represented about 10% of my fund. And so I'll never forget what that was like, what that felt like. And so you either share how I'm investing or don't invest. I'm doing what I love. Whatever this comes of my money management firm comes, you know, however it works out, if people want to invest, that's great. But I really want to focus on people really understand what I'm trying to do. And if they're bothered by volatility or they're bothered by the market, are they going to, you know, talk to me? And, you know, I launched this in April 1st, and not one of my clients has asked me since how I'm doing. And it's a small group, so it's kind of a curated group of people, which lets me do what I love, and I'm grateful for that.
It's a nice position to be in. So, I mean, do you feel like getting specific with any of your favorite names at all? I mean, if you don't want to, I understand how people are about
that. Yeah, no, one of the ones that I kind of, you know, sent out that it was publicly was just kind of a value investor's case for Twitter, which is a pretty large company. It's like a $18 billion enterprise value company, and is an example of what I view as just kind of a misunderstood company that maybe wouldn't traditionally screen as a value investment, but I believe that, you know, Twitter is the most powerful news and curation tool in the world, and it's more valuable to its users now than ever before. But you wouldn't know it by looking at the financials of the stock price. It's almost the same price as its IPO 7 years ago. But the value of its network has kind of grown exponentially. And it's just fascinating to watch, you know, kind of people misunderstand. I happen to love Twitter. As someone who's curious and wants to research, I think it's just the most amazing curation and learning tool I've ever encountered. And I'm not the only one who said that. Bill Gurley of, famous venture capitalist investor in Uber said basically it's the most amazing learning network, I said, that was built. And I think people don't really understand, people who are new to Twitter don't understand it. But the people that use it all the time, they constantly say, I can't believe this is free. I can't believe the service is free. You see this, you know, if not every day, multiple times a week from the people that I follow. And the problem for Twitter is they've struggled with their advertising technology. The CEO has been distracted, Jack Dorsey. He runs two different companies, Square and Twitter. And they kind of have a baffling strategy, kind of ignoring their power users, of which one I am one of them. And so what's really remarkable is, like, just to show you the value of Twitter, I felt like I was weeks ahead, if not a couple days ahead of the COVID news, when things started breaking in February. And not only did it allow me to prepare my family and make multiple Costco runs and stock up and make sure that we had extra medicine, et cetera, but I was able to position portfolio because I was worried about what was coming, because you start hearing news stories and I could immediately start following epidemiologists, world-class epidemiologists around the world, and people in Italy, in Asia, who were reporting about what was going on and understand what the risk of what was coming. And it's kind of the same thing of, a couple weeks ago, learning that people were like, hey, there's going to be if people aren't wearing masks, you're going to have a second kind of surge in these places that aren't encouraging. And I remember hearing a friend saying no one in Phoenix was wearing a mask and they were acting like everything was normal. And that was 3.5 weeks ago. And I said, well, not a rocket scientist, but I can figure out what that means if it's easily transmitted. So these are just like small examples of the power of Twitter. Every politician is on it. Every journalist is on it. You know, political Twitter is very powerful. Economist, the Economist kind of Twitter is really big. Academia has become more and more important. And they found that you have 50% more citations of your work in future work if you're on Twitter. In academia, finance, Intuit, they call it, it's just incredible for the sourcing of news, following things. You know, I was really interested earlier in what was going on with oil tankers and dry bulk shipping, and I was able to follow a Norwegian security analyst who shares his research for free, and also be able to get daily quotes of what the rates were. That's just like, and then follow both bulls and bears on both sides. It's a pretty amazing service. And at the same time, they're just not monetizing it properly because of a distracted management. And so then you ask, well, why is now different? Like, what's to stop managers from just keep either being distracted or not focused? And what happened is you had an activist go after them, Elliott Associates, earlier this year. And, you know, then a private equity firm came in as well. And there's like a three-way negotiation. And what happened is one of the world-class technology private equity investors, Silver Lake, and the CEO, Egon Durban, and a representative from Elliott Associates, Jesse Cohen, both joined the board. And so you had two board members join, an independent, and basically I believe that now you're at a point where management's either going to perform or you're going to have a change in management.
Cool. Yeah, I agree. I use Twitter all the time and I learn. It's amazing. I go on there every day. I'm on there every day and I always learn something. That's like my primary news feed now.
That's exactly right. It's like there's so much opportunity just in news. Like this is where news breaks. This is where people, you know, follow news, just in news itself. And you know what's so interesting is part of my thesis is that Twitter should start experimenting with subscriptions. Like monetize, there's a service called Stuff. It's really a shame. And this is part of the distracting, you know, TikTok is really big right now. Sure, very, very short video to music. Twitter had this like 7 years ago with Vine and just ignored it. You know, there's another service called Substack, which does subscription newsletters, makes it super easy. Like, that could be Twitter. Twitter should acquire them, in my humble opinion. There are all these, but the craziest thing is there's people out there who have stock recommendation, like newsletters and services, and have what's called locked accounts. Now on Twitter, what you can do is lock your account and only those people that you invite and accept can follow your feed. Okay, it can mean so that it doesn't is public. You can say what you want, et cetera, or you could just use it for market timing or recommendation. And I'm following this one guy, and this one guy says, "Well, you know, go to my website and sign up for my service, pay me, and then once I get your email, I'll invite you to my Twitter feed." And I'm just thinking to myself, how is this happening outside of the Twitter ecosystem? Like, how is this possible? And it just strikes me that there are a lot of different options that could be. There's power users like me that, frankly, if you would give me a little more functionality and a little more tools, I would happily pay for a Twitter premium service. What's also insane is you have all these corporations and blue check marks. These are verified people. Many of them corporations who use Twitter for customer service. They use Twitter to just create marketing for free, right? There's many of them that have over 100,000 followers. It's amazing to me. There's 58%. Here's a stat: 58% of the top brands have over 100,000 followers, and 80% of Twitter users have mentioned the brand. Do you know how much these brands pay for that kind of verified account, that blue check mark? They pay zero. They pay nothing. I saw a mention. I think Professor Scott Galloway, that, you know, that one of these, you know, God, I'm blanking on the name, one of the Kardashians, like literally will get paid a quarter of a million or $500,000 to send out a tweet. And she pays nothing to Twitter for that. Or to keep her Twitter account, like what would she pay for a monthly fee to have access? And it's what's you also see, you know, stories of like Donald Trump or other people who get, you know, upset at Twitter, but they can never leave Twitter. One, it's addictive. And two, there's nothing like it to give you a direct platform right to your audience and craft your narrative. And so that's why, like, Elon Musk, he literally got in trouble with the SEC. He basically broke the law. And as part of the SEC settlement, had to get someone to basically oversee his tweets. And he still can't stop tweeting. It's really an amazing thing. And how is it that there's so much power, and it has so much power that the government wants to regulate it, but they can't monetize? The stock price is the same as it was 7 years ago.
It's insane. It's as if the New York Times wasn't getting paid.
Yeah, yeah. New York Times is like all-time highs, right? They're cashing in on this like crazy. They're loving this environment. But I look at Twitter and I say to myself, you know, again, going back to the philosophy, by the way, multiple companies have tried to acquire Twitter before or have discussed it. Almost every major company out there. And so I look at it, and you have Silver Lake that just invested $1 billion with a convertible note that is like pays less than 1% interest and converts at $41.50 a share, stocks at $29. By the way, they made $5 billion in Skype and $10 billion bringing Dell private and then public again. These guys are very, very sophisticated, much, much smarter than I am. And so, you know, I look at this and I say, the downside is limited. Everybody knows that they've struggled, right? What happens if they stop struggling monetarily? What I mean by that is user engagement is through the roof. The power, you know, in April, the internet traffic to Twitter was the third fastest growing, up 39%. Higher than Facebook's 26%. By some estimates, Twitter only earns a third of what Facebook earns on its ads, even though Twitter users are more educated and wealthier. Like, it's really kind of remarkable how much is already kind of in the stock price and in the valuation. And just as an example, like, Facebook has like a $600 billion valuation. Twitter is, you know, 18, 19 billion. Like, it's not even the same ballpark. And yet, for some reason, this network and is always in the news, always breaking news, and people cannot get enough of it. And so, if I go to mindset's philosophy of low downside, I see, you know, the company has no debt, lots of cash, or it has no net debt. You have these two activists on the board. It's very, very clear something is going to happen. Like, something has to change or improve. And you look in terms of like the analyst coverage and how people view it. And it's remarkable how negative everyone is. You know, of the 44 analysts who cover Twitter, 30 have a hold recommendation, which is, you and I both know, is a sell. Four have a sell. So 34 of the 44 analysts basically saying, don't own this. Only 10 have buys. Now, compare it to Facebook, has 42 buy recommendations and four holds. So when I see things like that, I say, well, there's a lot of negativity around the company. The downside's relatively low. Usage and demand for its services through the roof. The real question is around execution and whether management can kind of turn around how they monetize the service. And I'm not saying that that's an easy task. I'm just saying that the downside's probably pretty low from here. Considering the amount of takeover interest in the past, if it continues to struggle, at least you know, monetizing its service. And the upside is simply, well, very uncertain, is enormous if they start to execute. Simply enormous. Or imagine they just bring in, you know, John Laguerre from T-Mobile. He's a free agent now. Guy took, like, what, the fourth, one of the worst, you know, cell phone companies, telecom companies out there, and completely turned it around, provided investors, even like a rock star. You imagine if they brought in someone whose full focus was this. I mean, the stock was completely, I don't even, they might go 50% in a day. And so this is the kind of, you know, if it is well known to me, like, the Twitter is misunderstood what it is. And things are starting to change. People aren't necessarily paying attention. And now that you have the activists in there, the clock is ticking.
Wow. Thank you for the impromptu deepish dive. I mean, for a podcast, pretty deep dive on Twitter.
Yeah, no, this is part of the thing. So it's like, so for me, it's like Twitter's going to be valuable whether COVID goes on or not. In a time of uncertainty, it's like, usage is going to be even greater, but you have sports returning and elect. And so what I'm trying to do is invest in these companies that I think are doing well or misunderstood regardless. What you won't hear, this is the first time in our conversation, or when I've been talking about Twitter, I even mentioned the virus, right? It's because to me, it's like, it's all about the opportunity is all in the deep dive and the fundamental research right now.
I'm glad I let you do that, but we're sort of at the end of our time. I would like to ask you my usual question here at the end, because in your case, as excited as you are, I'm really curious to hear your answer. And what I ask all my guests at the end is, if you could leave our listeners with just one thought today, what would that be?
If you don't use Twitter, I would sign on and I would start following people and I would start using the service. But I'll give you a second free one, and that is, I think the opportunity in today is in small cap value and fundamental research. While everyone is paying attention to the macro and the craziness of what's going on and trying to day trade.
Oh, beautiful message. Thank you for that. A free one, a second one. Thank you. All right, Aaron. Look, we're going to have you back on, I hope, sooner rather than later. We really love talking with you.
I really appreciate it. It's an honor to be on the podcast. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. We'll see you sometime soon.
Sounds great, Dan. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Aaron. Wow, that was a lot of fun. Man, Aaron always delivers a great idea. Who knew Twitter was such a fantastic idea? I've heard it from other analysts, but I haven't heard it, frankly, just, you know, with that much depth and passion. And I asked him for one idea, and he said, get on Twitter. I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, he just really believes in it. Wow, a very fruitful interview for you as a listener. I hope you feel that way. Sounded that way to me. All right, let's see what's in the mailbag. Are you being left behind? Most Americans are, and like we've never seen before. The gap between rich and poor is growing at exponential levels and speed. Thousands in our country ascend into millionaire status. Meanwhile, surveys show 60% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings. That's why, for the first time ever, one of America's ultra-successful multimillionaires has gone on camera to explain the real reason for America's huge wealth gap. Plus, the three steps you must take immediately to make sure you are on the right side of this trend. Get the facts for yourself for a better understanding of how this new economy works. Watch this multimillionaire's important new video and learn the three important steps to take today free. Go online to www.growingwealthgap.com. Visit growingwealthgap.com now. In the mailbag each week, you and I get to have an honest conversation about investing or whatever is on your mind. Just send your questions, comments, and politely worded criticisms to feedback@investorhour.com. I read every word of every email you send me, and I respond to as many as possible. Lots of good stuff this week. Bitcoin. So the first Bitcoin question, I think there's two of them here, is from John M. And John M. says, what do you think of GBTC as an alternative to buying Bitcoin itself? I realize it trades at a premium to the actual asset, but it is also easier and more liquid. You don't have to worry about opening and funding an account, maintaining a wallet, losing the key, etc. Is it worth it? John M. John, I have no use for GBTC besides the premium to the asset. I just buy the asset. It's so easy. And you can store it offline. The point is not to like trade a stock. So the easier, more liquid, it's not really worth that much to me. And Bitcoin is plenty liquid. If you want to sell your Bitcoin, you can do it in a second. Okay? Literally, a second. So the liquidity issue for me is not a problem at all. And even the ease of use, you said it's easier and more liquid. It's really easy to open up a Coinbase account and transfer some money and buy some Bitcoin. And you said, like, you don't have to worry about opening, funding an account, maintaining a wallet, losing the key. I mean, if all that's a problem, I don't think all that's a big hassle. So maybe you and I don't see eye to eye on this. I don't buy GBTC. Why would I buy something that trades at a premium like that? The thing I don't like about it is it doesn't give me real diversification. When everybody's selling every stock in a big drawdown, I think they'll probably sell that one too. I want to keep my Bitcoin away from the stock market. It's like gold to me, outside of the financial system. I don't want to financialize it by buying a stock. All right. Good question, though. Good question. Okay. Here's a fantastic question. We're going to spend a little time on this because it's really important. Dave M. says, longtime listener, thanks for the great perspective you provide. I have a question about Bitcoin. Lots of discussion today is around the limited supply and thus the hardness of Bitcoin. However, I'm not sure cryptos aren't just as fragile as any other fiat currency system, which can print with just a few keystrokes. There's a limited supply of Bitcoin, 21 million coins, but tomorrow I can decide to print more cryptocurrency by introducing Bitcoin 2. Then next year I can create Bitcoin 3. As long as I can find a way of making each new Bitcoin clone attractive to people, how is that not the equivalent of printing more dollars? All of a sudden, there are 61 million Bitcoin, 1, 2, and 3, instead of the original 21 million. It would actually be 63 million, but okay. Help me understand where this thinking is wrong. Dave M. So I reached out to Eric Wade. He's the boss man of our crypto posse around Stansberry. And I always defer to him on these technical Bitcoin questions. He has mined cryptocurrencies. He's been there and done that. He knows cryptos better than anybody I know. And he says, fair question. There's a long and short answer to it. The short answer is, yes, you can create Bitcoin too. However, when you ask the next natural question, the value of, you know, Bitcoin 1 becomes more apparent. And the next question is, how do I get my Bitcoin 2 into everyone's hands? How do I catch up with Bitcoin 1 such that people may replace them or mistake them for each other? Because Eric says, initially, Bitcoin 2 is infinite inflation of itself. It's not Bitcoin 1. Bitcoin 2 is, in fact, brand new free money. If you give it away, it's free money. You can make people work for it. If you can make people work for it, Bitcoin 1 has an 11-plus year head start. And then for me, this is kind of the key here. He says, Bitcoin 1 is old, well-distributed, millions of users, and some people have fought, bled, innovated, thought, argued, invested, mined, and protested on their way to acquire Bitcoin 1. Bitcoin 2 will have none of that. So what if you make Bitcoin 2 literally down to the last digit identical to Bitcoin 1? Note, you can. It's open source software. Congratulations, you just joined the back of the Bitcoin 1 line and you will need to overpower the most powerful computer network of all time to be in charge. Okay, then moving on, he says, the interesting thing about this question is there's already plenty of Bitcoin 2 and 3s out there. One of them, Bitcoin Cash, has been around 3 years, spent millions on marketing and partnerships and so forth, and even misinformation campaigns trying to convince investors it's the real Bitcoin. After all that, Bitcoin Cash hasn't even captured 2.5% of Bitcoin's market cap, and that number is likely inflated. Here's the thing. Bitcoin isn't just a few lines of software. It's an infrastructure. There are miners in more than 100 countries. There are easy ways to buy it, store it, and trade it. More than 300 developers around the world who have continued to contribute code to the project. 10,000 nodes maintained in every corner of the globe, 100% by volunteers. Bitcoin startups have received billions of dollars in investments, and some of the biggest players in money are moving to support it, including Fidelity, PayPal, Chicago Board Options Exchange, Intercontinental Exchange, which owns the New York Stock Exchange. With every day that passes, Bitcoin's moat as the leading store of value in crypto gets larger. Just like anyone can make up their own paper bills and pass them off as a new form of money, anyone can make their own Bitcoin. That doesn't mean people will use it. It all comes down to users. Bitcoin has virtually all of the users right now, and it adds more every day. Okay, I'm going to let Eric's comments stand on their own. He's the man. And good question. Thank you very much. Next comes Paul P., and he says, I hope you and your family are well. I really enjoy the podcast, the format, and the learning opportunities for the listener. I would appreciate your opinion, please. Would you compare the concepts buy right and sit tight with using stop losses, be it trailing or hard stop, if the story behind the investment has not changed? Thank you for your help, Paul P. This is a fantastic question because I, for years, never used trailing stops. Then I was shown some data that said, hey, Dan, your portfolio would have done better if you'd used trailing stops. I think I made all my mistakes around, big events like not selling soon enough in, 2007 or 8 or something. Or selling during the event rather than riding it out, that kind of thing. So if you're going to do that, if you're going to sell at the bottom or something, or, during a big sell-off, sure, trailing stops are going to help you. And we use some trailing stops in extreme value now. And so far, so good. However, we also have some picks where we say we're not going to use a stop. And we have a handful of those now because we think we understand the business and we think it's so good you can just buy it and hold it forever. And if it goes down 30 or 40%, big deal. It'll be back up, and you'll make plenty of money over the long term. So, yeah, Paul, I think that's the best I can do for you. It's up to you to decide when to use stops and when not to. I think stops help people who trade too much and who really have no business trading too much. They should just index or buy, Porter Stansberry's forever stocks and forget they own them for 10 years. But they won't do that, see? And that really is like the pioneer of trailing stops in Stansberry was not Porter, it was Steve Sugarrood. Years and years ago, before Stansberry Research existed. And so he did it because, his experience as a broker, like he just saw people selling out at the bottom again and again and again, and it broke his heart. So he thought, if you just use trailing stops, you'll lose a lot less, and therefore you'll make a lot more over time. So I hope that's a good answer, Paul. That's all I got for you. All right, finally, we get to Lincoln B., MD. Lincoln wrote a very long email. I can't read all of it. Just read a little bit of it. He says, some of your comments on COVID-19 distress me. I cringe whenever I hear anyone imply that it might turn out to be not that bad or the issue is overblown. I am not trying to quote you, but this is the sense that I get from you and some of your colleagues, Porter, for instance, and even Doc Eifrig to some extent. And then really long email. And at the end, he says, so I ask that you reconsider and moderate your position, at least supporting government-mandated public mask use, and also emphatically communicate how serious this pandemic is and how supremely selfish it is not to wear a mask in public. Lincoln B., MD. I don't know if I need to change my opinion here, Lincoln. I think that everybody should make their own decision. I did note an article about Japan in regard to wearing masks in public, and it made the point that Japan is the kind of society where you wear a mask in public out of politeness and deference to your fellow man. It would be downright rude not to wear a mask when you could potentially make someone ill. And I liked the sound of that. I liked the sound of that, as a feature of a culture and a feature of just, the way this entire country lives its life every day, rather than, the government mandate. But you know something? Look, I try not to be dogmatic about politics. And so I have to go the other way too. If you're not dogmatic about politics, it doesn't mean that the government has no place ever doing anything. It means that if the government ought to do something that will really be a lot better for everybody, then, maybe it ought to do it. I think what those of us who are skeptical might say to that is the government never stops there, right? They never stop at saying everybody needs to wear a mask. That's the problem. You know, the little bit of service that government provides that really makes life a lot better, everyone looks at that and says, oh, that's great. Let's do a lot more with government. And then that's a disaster. Everything they touch turns to crap. But I hear you, Lincoln. It's not a bad point. Not sure I'd go as far as a government mandate. But if nothing else, you know, just out of respect for your fellow man, maybe you should wear a mask in public. People who say, screw you, I'm not wearing a mask. I don't know if I like that guy very much. He's not a bad guy. You know, I was talking about good guys and bad guys. He's not a bad guy, but, you know, I think he might be wrong about this. I'm torn. Sometimes I wear a mask in public if I go into a crowded place, and sometimes I don't. You know, when I go to pick up sushi, everybody in the sushi place, like I'm the only guy in there, and everybody in there has a face mask or like one of those shields, and they've got this big plastic thing you have to reach underneath to hand them your credit card or whatever. And then you don't even hand them the credit card. You just put it in the machine and pull it back out. You pull a pen out, you sign the thing, and you take your dirty pen and you put it in the dirty pen pile. And they go and they sanitize all the pens at some point. So I tend to think that even with this, to say everybody has to do it, it's all one way or it's all the other, to me, that is usually the mistake. But it's a good question, obviously. You heard me kind of waffling and thinking out loud. That means it's a really good question, in my opinion. All right, that's another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Do me a favor, subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, help us grow with a rate and a review. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is @InvestorHour. Also, follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @Investor_Hour. Have a guest you want me to interview? Drop us a note at feedback@InvestorHour.com. Till next week, I'm Dan Ferris. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. To access today's notes and receive notice of upcoming episodes, go to investorhour.com and enter your email. Have a question for Dan? Send him an email, feedback@investorhour.com. This broadcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered personalized investment advice. Trading stocks and all other financial instruments involves risk. You should not make any investment decision based solely on what you hear. Stansberry Investor Hour is produced by Stansberry Research and is copyrighted by the Stansberry Radio Network.